All right. So good morning, everybody. Welcome, welcome, welcome to the House of the Risen Sun with Bruce Rawls and Lynn Johnson. And we're here this week. We're talking again, still yet, continuing. We're on page, I think, 108 of the Lifetimes When Jesus and Buddha Knew Each Other, A History of Mighty Companions with Gary Renard. And so we've been plodding away through this, but I'm telling you, I'm getting a lot out of it. So I'm really grateful for this chance to really thoroughly go through this, even though it's kind of a story and it's like, you know, about people and, you know, getting together and talking and doing different things. You know, we see and we learn so much from it. So it's beautiful and perfect. So how was your week, Bruce? Anything going on with you?
Well, I was joking with some friends who stopped by the other day that our situation dropped from a 4-ring to a 3-ring circus the other day when I handled an issue that had been but hanging over my head for a long time. So now the main thing that's going on is a big site I'm working on, which I've already talked about. We're gonna launch that soon, and then we've set a date for it, and then a week from yesterday, there's a new European regulation that comes out that's called GDPR. And if you haven't already noticed a bunch of emails coming in from online services saying, we've updated our privacy policy and our terms of service, you probably will be deluged with those over the next few days, because this is even though it's a European law, it applies to any website that can reach people in Europe, which means basically every website. So I've been, you know, getting together a whole bunch of best practices and scrambling to learn all the new things that are available very quickly in the last few days that allow people to comply with this regulation, which is actually a really good thing, because it helps people with promoting, you know, better security and privacy for citizens of the European Union who can live anywhere, of course, including the United States, but also, you know, just kind of be more transparent and be, you know, above the board in terms of what they're doing and why and what data they're collecting and all that kind of stuff. So it's all about that. So while I'm doing this, I'm, you know, the metaphysical symbolism is not lost on me that the whole notion of privacy and security really is contingent on the idea of there being separate selves, because in pure oneness, what need would you have for privacy and security of your personal data? What person?
Well, exactly. Yeah. I trust my brothers to work one with me.
And right.
Once you hit that point, then you don't need any of that other crap, right?
And exactly.
We convince ourselves that we do, and so we live in fear. You know what's really interesting to me, and you're talking about these European rules, and I know a lot of people in America who are really interested in like environmental regulations and, you know, just all the things that we look at and say, oh, this is really good that we're taking care of this and fixing this and making sure that this doesn't happen. And we have all these ideas. And of course, American businesses look at it and say, well, that's not good for us, because now we have to, you know, follow all these regulations and not pollute.
Sure.
And, you know, not, you know, I used to live out, no, I'm an environmental engineer. So I've done numerous jobs on Superfund sites and seen the actual devastation that comes about when we mishandle toxic chemicals. And, you know, it's pretty compelling when you're on that system and you believe that, you know, all these things can be harmful to us. And, we're only hurting ourselves, you know, which, you know, there's a conflict there, you know, believe it or not, because of course America tells me, well, no, it doesn't, you know, there's nothing really that can harm you. So all this work you're doing is really for your imaginary thought system. But anyway, but we in America who are thinking about these things are alarmed because of, you know, certain people in our government that are trying to get rid of it. And yet in Europe and other countries, is very much a part of their lives and a very much a fact. They understand climate change and they understand, you know, what happens with when toxic chemicals run amok and pollution becomes, you know, deadly. And, you know, they understand those things. And so they have regulations in place that are meant to stop those things and protect us. And any company in America who does business with companies in the European Union or Australia or any place where they have those rules in place, we have to comply with those rules. Uh-huh. We have to comply. You know, ISO, International Standards Organization, has rules and regulations for how we do business. And so if we want to do business on the global market, then we have to comply with those rules. So here in America, where we're saying throw out all those rules, all we're doing is cutting off our ability to trade globally and have, you know, have a global economy. Mm-hmm. And so you know, we're really just cutting off our noses to spite our face. But the thing that's so wonderful is that our folks in these other countries, they understand the dilemma that we're in. A lot of people really understand the dilemma that we're in, that we have this leadership in place that is completely oblivious to the world in general, and in fact completely oblivious to themselves. And so, you know, unable to really have any kind of a consciousness of the world. And yet, you know, the world has got our back. And people like this, the Iran deal, which is, you know, making a big news in the news now, other countries who are part of that deal are not backing out, you know, and Iran is not backing out. Iran is saying we're going to still follow these rules and we're going to still do this thing. And so they're holding up their end, even while we're kind of dropping ours over here. Uh-huh. And they're having faith that we're going to wake up and realize that sooner or later, you know, that what we're doing is not conducive to the general welfare. That, you know, that's a word out of the actual preamble of the Constitution to promote the general welfare.
Uh-huh. And in general, if you generalize to include everyone and everything, would have to be pan global. You know, it'd have to include, you know, any extraterrestrial interest from any other galaxies. I mean, why would we try to exclude any part of perfect oneness? And I think that's the, you know, the irony, of course, of any assumption on our part that as citizens or countries or any other entity that seems to be apart from any other entity, how could that possibly work? Even on the level of form, it's just silly, you know. I mean,
no man is an island.
So obviously there's plenty of opportunities for level of confusion there, but you know, I think your point is well taken, is that, you know, even in this world of duality, it's just silly to shoot yourself in the foot when you realize that you know, your livelihood, your health, your relationships, everything that we think of as important in the world, all are contingent on a certain modicum of functionality in this dysfunctional world, you know, to keep us going, you know, for at least a little while, of, you know, a few decades of for each body kind of thing, you know. But isn't it crazy, you know, how we, you know, it's the whole shoot yourself in the foot mentality, that we don't realize that, you know, every other part of ourself that seems to be outside of ourself is really, it's our own foot, you know. It's like,
yeah,
put the damn pistol away. drop the sword, you know. Yeah, I think Jesus was, he didn't use gunpowder powered weapons. He uses terms like sword and shield and spear and of course in Miracles, to be kind of more Shakespearean and poetic, I think. But it's, you know, it's all the same. You know, the ego's nuclear warheads, you know, are no different than the slightest, you know, a blowgun or a spitwad or anything else. You know, anything that was meant to defend or harm or or other in our mind is really an opportunity to look at why we think that we're in danger, and as we know right off the bat from our curriculum that nothing real can be threatened and nothing unreal exists, and herein lies our peace that we thought we left and we thought was just somehow tucked away in the mind of God and somehow we can't get back to. But well, this is what we're here to do, is to return to it by removing the tumbleweeds from and the and the decoy camouflage that we put to discourage us from looking at where we know we're going to find the peace. Right. Anyway. Enough ramble.
Absolutely. And it just reminded me of that. There's a song by Styx. I think you probably know this song. So you're fooling yourself and you don't believe it. You're hurting yourself, but you don't believe it. You know?
That's pretty good lyrics. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know if you know that song or if you're.
I guess I haven't heard that one.
Yeah, but I'm a big Styx fan. So Mr. Yeah. Roboto and all. Anyway. Cool. Let's.
Should we dive back into Gary's fourth book?
Yeah, let us dive into the book. And we ended up last week. We were talking about still in the Gnostic traditions section, and I've got us on page 108. I'm not sure.
That's where I have us too. What do you say we back up about a page?
Okay.
Just to get the context, because it kind of the first paragraph is sort of in the middle, yeah. So,
yeah.
So how about if we go back to where Artin and the previous page says, getting back to non-duality.
Okay. All righty. Let me get back there then. Let me get back to there.
Okay. Get back.
Getting back to non-duality. Get back to where you never belong. Oh, no. Get back to where you once belonged. Okay. So you want me to read? All right.
Sure. Sure.
Okay, this is Artin speaking. Getting back to non-duality, the Gnostics use the word gnosis, G-N-O-S-I-S, in much the same way the Course uses the word knowledge. I think they both mean the same thing, I'm not sure. In both cases, we're not talking about intellectual knowledge or the imparting of information. We're talking about having the actual experience of your perfect oneness of God. You've had the experience the Course calls revelation, right? Okay, let's just stop right here a moment. Okay, the Course talks about this experience called revelation. And, I've been in a conversation with somebody for a while on Facebook who, you know, has had revelation and seems to think nobody else has. But what they're considering revelation may be a little bit different than what I consider revelation or what Bruce considers revelation or whatever. You know, what do you think revelation means? And I'm just asking this because, you know, I have an idea in my head. Oh, I have an idea forming in my head. And
you're Matt, waxing both musical and accent-y this morning.
Yes.
Fun.
Hey, well, it's because I've been up all night watching that dang wedding.
Oh, okay.
So I'm like, oh, wing.
So how's that going? Did they throw the rice, cut the cake, and all that?
You know, it was the most amazing thing, Bruce.
Yeah.
It was so beautiful. They have this bishop who's, I guess, the bishop of all the whatever that Church of England or whatever the heck it is. He was an American guy, though. Anyway, he his whole entire talk was about love and about gnosis, about what God's love is and how God sees us and how we, you know, it was all about love. It was just amazing. I mean, I was sitting up, and of course I'm in bed, you know, sitting up and just tears rolling down my face. I'm just so impressed and so amazed by this talk about love. And, you know, I couldn't agree more that, you know, what the world needs now is love, sweet love. But this wedding is like an example of, I mean, this is so completely, can you imagine 30, 40, 50 years ago, a British royal marrying a black American divorced actress?
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
I mean, it just would not have been, even thought about. And now it's like the world is rejoicing. And, you know, it's just so lovely. But anyway, back to the talk of revelation. In your understanding, what is revelation?
Well, I think we could look it up in the Course, and there's several references to it. It seemed like fairly early on in the text, actually. But I think, you know, my recollection without doing that is that it's, you know, this is a direct experience of oneness with our source. And, you know, and it obviously defies explanation, and it would be in the ineffable category, because I think those experiences would be something that you couldn't even begin to describe. And I think that's why seemed like we might have been reading last week, or maybe it was a different study group, the part where it talks about something about intensely personal. I've been so many things online, I kind of forget sometimes. But I remember making the comment, so I was like, well, for me, it's intensely transpersonal, I think, would be, a more appropriate. But it's like there's still a sense of self, but it's not a personal self. It's the inclusive self. And I think that's the experience that is beyond the curriculum of A Course in Miracles, but is what A Course leads up to. And that's why in the epilogue it says this course is a beginning, not an ending. And it basically suggests that, you know, we can have glimpses of that experience, and Gary talks about having that. And I think if anybody really looks at the feelings and the thoughts and the promptings that we've all had throughout our life to look for something better and we have these moments of respite and of peace. I think those are indicative. Most of those are probably miracle moments, as the Course would describe them or define them, where, you know, we momentarily let go of our belief in separation. And I think those are sort of like the reflections of epiphanies that speak to revelation. I don't think I personally have had the kind of revelation that's being talked about here, although I think I've had, you know, moments of peace that I couldn't really describe necessarily. So you know, maybe I don't know. I think it's something that once, you know, you experience that, there's a certain quality of, okay, I can never go back to trying to make this world work. anyway, I'm just kind of rambling right. Again, but I think the idea is that it's an awareness of an experience that defies description, that is so profoundly wonderful that you couldn't begin to put it into words. And I think that's really not the aim of the course directly, but indirectly. And in a number of places, it refers to the fact that, you know, that it's really beyond the scope of the course, but really is, you know, the idea behind it is that we will all become aligned with that identity that really is that teacher of kindness, that awareness that we took with us into the dream, to where there's no question whatsoever, there's no equivocation, there's no doubt, there's a certainty, and there's a peace and an innocence and a loving kindness that is our identity that's revealed to us that we couldn't possibly forsake or leave. And I think you know, something along those lines. And I'm trying to put words to something that you can't put words to. So
Well, that's pretty good, and I guess that's correct. I think for me, you know, I've had, but you know, I think is what the course describes as revelation experiences, where I have been just completely unaware of my own self,
uh-huh.
and completely like united in one, not separate from everything and everyone. And you know, I've had, you know, experiences like that on, you know, several occasions, and you know, every time, this is what's so interesting, and I recognize it now that I see what it was, you know, and I understand it, but every single time there came a point at which I said, when will this be over? I wonder how much longer this is going to last.
Right.
And then it's like done, because that is the ego just coming in and saying, okay, enough of this stuff.
Uh-huh.
You know, you're getting way out there, and time to get back to work, or time to come back to the mind, or time to start, you know, living your life. Because at one point in an experience that I had, I actually literally thought, I hope I don't stay this way for the rest of my life. I willingly said, I don't want this anymore because it is so, I don't know how I can live with it. I don't know how I can live and think, feel this way, be this way. And, so I can't describe it either. It really is just a complete and total awareness of all things and a feeling of being loved, which again, I rejected like almost immediately, saying, I don't deserve this. What this is for somebody else, is not for me. And, I look back now and I think, oh my God, you know, what if I had just accepted it and not rejected it and just went for it and, you know, been brave enough to, you know, jump off the cliff. You know, I mean, basically that's what it feels like. It feels like if I let this go on anymore, it's almost like having an orgasm, and I don't want to mix metaphors here, but Gary talks about it that way too, I think.
Mm-hmm. It's actually in the next page, the sentence we were about to read before we backed up.
Oh yeah. Okay.
So
that's what it is. And you know that if that sensation were to continue forever or for even another minute, you would probably just disintegrate. You know, you couldn't have that sustained, that experience for a long period of time, or else you would just like, blah, you know, I can't exist in this world anymore. And so, you know, you run away from it, you reject it, you stop it, let's go have a cigarette now, kind of thing. But I don't smoke, but just an example. But yeah, I mean, that's it. So when Artin says you've had what the Course calls a revelation, then Gary says, yes, the same thing. Revelation in the Course doesn't mean that special information is revealed to you. It's referring to an experience that's so amazing, it's literally indescribable, way beyond words. That experience of the awareness of perfect oneness blows away anything that this world has to offer. It gives you a taste of the truth and is a constant state. Rather than the impermanence of the dream. And you're saying some Gnostics experience the same thing, a reality beyond the veil of the illusory universe? He's asking him. And yes, that is exactly what it is. They experience the reality of the veil, and see that it's not true. So Artin says, absolutely. There have always been people who experienced that. It can happen to anyone at any time, and you don't have to be that spiritually advanced in order for it to hit you by surprise. I say surprise because it usually happens when you don't expect it. So the people reading this shouldn't, let me go to the next page, waste their time looking for it. Also, if it happens, it doesn't make you special. In some cases, the Holy Spirit is helping you to have that experience in order to encourage you, to help keep you going. Plus, there are very advanced students who don't have that experience in this lifetime. But how do they know they didn't already have it in another lifetime? There's no sense in trying to figure out why it happens to some and not to others. Just understand that it happens to every mind at some time or another. It's kind of like a preview of coming attractions. You get a sense of what your reality is eventually going to always be like outside of time. And this is where Gary says, Gary, the orgasmic aspect of it is awesome too. We made up our relationships in this world as a substitute for the relationship we thought we lost in God. But sex in this world pales by comparison. That's because only minds can join in a permanent way. Bodies can't really join. Not that we won't try, but union with God takes place through the mind, which, as you said, activates the experience of spirit. Then Persis says, the Course describes your relationship with God as intensely personal, and it is. The Gnostic treasured that experience of Gnosis. To achieve it, they try to remember the world as just a dream, as you read in the Gospel of Truth. To them, the world wasn't made by God, but by a demiurge, which is roughly equivalent to the course term ego, and they are trying to transcend it and back to go back to reality, which is called pleroma in some of the Gnostic traditions. But the students would often get discouraged if the experience of Gnosis didn't happen for them. Making a false idol out of the experience and being disappointed if it doesn't happen won't get you anywhere. Then, of course, a lot of them made the same mistake most people do. They made the world real. They gave truth to their illusions. So many of them remained in a state of duality, just as many course students do. And, well, of course, they came from the place where the world is real. And so they have to, you know, there is a conflict. If you you can't see two worlds. You can only see one world. That used to really confuse me, and I used to think it was a rule, and I thought that God imposed that on us. And, you know, why can't I see both? But I recognize that it's because if I'm looking at one, I can't see the other. And if I'm looking at the other, I can't see the one. So it's me that did that. It's me that made a rule that says you have a mind that can only think about one thing at a time. And even though it may seem like you're thinking about lots of things at the time, in reality, your mind thinks in a linear way, and you can only think one thought at a time. The idea you could think two thoughts at the same time is an error. It's ridiculous.
We can seem to go back and forth really quickly, though, can't we? I mean, it's,
yeah.
I mean, I figure if our minds are that agile and we don't recognize it, you know, it could be at the level of what's called the Planck time constant, which is about 10 to the 44th times per second, which is apparently what, you know, some physicists are saying, that the universe literally, you know, is destroyed and recreated that many times per second, which means that, you know, if someone says you don't have an opportunity to change your mind, you could say, well, in the last second, you've had 10 to the 44th times an opportunity 10 to the 44th times to change your mind, you know. But obviously, for the most part, we tend to be a little slower than that in terms of flipping back and flopping back and forth. But anyway.
But Jesus does tell us that we do that. We make those choices like that, and we don't even recognize it. We think we didn't choose.
Yeah.
That's the problem, is that we think we didn't choose. We think that it just happened. But when you walk it back, you can always come to the place where you chose that picture, you chose that thought. And recognizing how tricky the mind is, and how really confused we are about what we are and what's really happening here.
It's kind of like, I think of it as kind of like pulling a boat out of the water. Is it happens so fast that the water, you know, rushes in to fill the space that your hand was in the water, or a boat was in the water, and if you pull something out of the water, that we don't think of it as being, you know, instantaneous, but it's really, you know, it takes a finite amount of time in terms of the laws of physics, but for all intents and purposes, it's pretty instantaneous, right?
Yes, so, absolutely. Yeah. And as far as our ability to recognize it, because
and that's why it's such a subtle thing too, because, you know, the ego is so quick to make sure that no thoughts of oneness get in, and no thoughts of shared interest that would threaten its alleged reality, that it immediately jumps in and fills the void, because that's what we trained that part of our mind to do. And I think that's why this course is such a, you know, emphasizes mind training, and the fact that it's, you know, ideas don't leave their source, and that it's always about, you know, being gently vigilant to look at our thoughts, because that's really the way out of the apparent predicament that we have put ourselves in, that appears to give reality to a material world and an identity that's separate from other identities and all that craziness.
Exactly. So do you want me to continue on this, and then I'll do this next paragraph, and then you can read from Arden. Okay. So another error they made was to identify with their projection. Today, many spiritual students are taught to look at something in the world and say, I am that. But in fact, you are not that. And Actually, the book I Am That by Nisargadatta, actually it's not a, he didn't write it, but it's his talks that somebody transcribed. Actually, his thought is neti neti, not this, not that. And so the whole thing of looking at I am what I am is not this and not that. And it's really easy then to reject it. Like today's lesson says, which is, I will accept atonement for myself, for I am as God created me. If I am as God created me, then I am not this or that. You know, and I could never be this or that. I can only be what God created. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you understand that, if you really get that, well, then you probably wouldn't be here listening to us. But
you'd be having a pure non-dual experience, which one might call revelation.
Exactly. Okay, so anything you see out there in the universe is a symbol. It's a projection, a hologram that's symbolic of that which is buried in your own unconscious mind. Though some of it is symbolic of the wholeness, most of it's based on separation. Yes, it's representative of what's hidden in your mind, but it's not you. You don't want to identify with it. You want to forgive it, especially if it affects you in any kind of negative way. It may seem noble to be one with the universe until you remember there is no universe. What you want to be is one with is God, which is all that truly exists. And so that's a huge differentiation. And when we say, I want to be oneness with humans, well, being oneness is a symbol of not two-ness.
Mm-hmm.
but unless you can see it that way, then you're thinking, you know, I'm one with the tree, I'm one with the, there is no tree. You know, I'm one with the spoon. There is no spoon. I'm not one with anything. I'm one with God. Let me remember, I'm one with God.
And a quick disclaimer, we're not dissing Tunisia either.
Oh yeah, no. Yeah. No Tunisians are fine with this recording.
There you go. I love it.
All right. You want to go ahead and continue to read. I am going to run and get my husband a cup of coffee. That'll take about 2 minutes. So,
okay. All right.
All right.
Okay, for anybody who might be just joining us, Lynn Johnson and I have been reading from Gary Renard's fourth book, which is The Lifetimes When Jesus and Buddha Knew Each Other, A History of Mighty Companions, by Gary R. Renard. And we've been reading this on these Saturday mornings for quite a while now, and finally got all the way up to the top of page 109. So if you want to follow along, if you have a copy of that, a hard copy or Kindle, and you can find your place. Highly recommended book. So I'll read on where Artin begins to continue the conversation. He says, Gnosticism and its teachings ended up being a mixed bag like everything else. Some of the students were really into God and some didn't want to have anything to do with God. The Gnostic systems weren't developed enough, even though Valentinus was a genius. Like Lao Tzu, he lived non-duality, but he had a hard time getting his students to do the same thing. Still, many of them made enormous strides on their spiritual path and are studying the Course today, ready to attain their enlightenment. The Course gives them the whole picture they need. If you look carefully, as we will on our last few visits of this series, you'll see the Course doesn't leave you with a bunch of unanswered questions. It tells you what existed before time began, which was given to you by God, how you appeared to get here, exactly what you can do about it, and where you're going home and how to get there. Not that heaven is a place. It's an awareness you need to reawaken in, and how the Holy Spirit has a plan that's guaranteed to result in that happening for everyone. Well, that's a pretty good curriculum, huh? Not that it's the one that our ego wants. Just kind of an aside to what we were sharing earlier about, you know, the strategy that often we do that seems to be, you know, fighting the ego and what Lynn was talking about, the not this, not that kind of thing, the neti neti. It doesn't mean that we deny our sensory data on the level of form. It just means that we look at that with a gentle amusement and what Course calls forgiveness, which is to say that, you know, we don't make a big deal out of what happens or doesn't happen in the world by practicing the state in our mind that sees that had no impact on the spirit that we really all are. Even if we don't really get what that is, there's a prompting and a guidance that we all have that we couldn't possibly shake off, that or sabotage, even though our egos try, that really does lead us back to the curriculum that was just discussed here. So, you know, that we do get the whole picture. We do get the whole way out, as the Course puts it. And that whole way out really is simply through forgiving our belief that separation was possible, and looking at, on a day-to-day practical level, looking at every thought that crosses our mind at that 10 to the 44th times per second rate. Maybe not quite that, you know. Maybe it'll take a little more practice before we catch the little thoughts that snip through super fast like that. But just to, you know, to notice how often, you know, we indulge in the desolate, really unmeaningful, unpleasant, unhappy, disparaging ideas that the ego suggests that any part of the sonship, which is, you know, all of creation, which means everyone and everything, could be less than perfect spirit, less than all of spirit. And I think that's why this curriculum is so challenging, is because we want to leave people out. And both Gary's curriculum and teachers, as well as Ken Wapnick's commentaries on the Course, you know, suggest that at every turn, is that we need to look at the ways that we want to exclude, and that's kind of like what Lynn was talking about, you know, those, and we all have them. We all have those investments that we want to make certain things special that we think are better than other things, you know, the special loves, and we have things that we still think are a threat, and those are the special hates, and the things that we defend against and we defend for, you know, just all you have to do is turn on a TV or, you know, look at the news on your computer or phone or, you know, wherever, you know, see that the world is really all about making a big deal over differences. Even if it's not overt war, there's always something that's happening, that to reflect and reinforce the idea of separation. But separation isn't the problem. It's the belief that separation exists in our mind that is really at the crux of what we're getting at here. So I'll read a little further. Gary goes on to say, I think it's frustrating for people because the Holy Spirit can see the whole plan and how it's all going to play itself out. The Holy Spirit can see everything that ever appeared to happen or ever will. The Course talks about an interlocking chain of forgiveness. So my forgiveness is connected to everyone else's forgiveness. But I can't see it, and the Holy Spirit can. Could Jay and Mary and Nadav see it? And Jay and Mary and Nadav are the three, the dynamic trio, I guess you could say, that Jesus and Mary Magdalene and Buddha in a previous lifetime, who was Nadav in his last lifetime, all basically ascended together by getting the curriculum of A Course in Miracles. Not that they would have called it that at that time, of course. And so, and Persa says, in answer to that question of could the three of them see it, Persa says, yes, when you've forgiven everything and your mind has been completely healed by the Holy Spirit, then by definition, all of the barriers that limited the power of your mind have been undone. Then you're high enough above the battleground, as the Course would say, to see the big picture. But even then, as long as you appear to be in a body, you'll focus on your part in the plan and have complete faith in the Holy Spirit. Remember, even the J guy followed the Holy Spirit. The Holy Spirit didn't follow him. That's an important reminder, isn't it? So, yeah, it really is so important because it's, and I love how one of Gary's comments that appears again and again is that, you know, Jesus wasn't the ultimate leader. He was the ultimate follower. And if we can remember that our job is to follow the guidance of that inner kindness teacher that is the Jesus of A Course in Miracles and is really, you know, the symbol of the Holy Spirit, as the Course in Miracles talks about, that really takes care of it. And that guidance is always to forgive. It's always to look at the contents of our mind, to not make big deals out of outcomes in a dream world, and remember, because it's a dream, that our innocence and our perfection as one being has never been compromised or threatened. And if we can just kind of, you know, moment to moment, day to day, you know, day in, day out, keep that in perspective, it'll help us be kinder and ironically, on the level of form, more effective. Not that that's our goal is to fix the dream, but to just remember that if we can, you know, keep those ideas in our mind and remember to trust that guidance, you know, we have a deluxe supersonic transport or a jet, you know, jet powered ticket out of the ego's hell. And I think if we look at our guidance week in you know, and how we followed it in the past, we probably wouldn't be having this discussion or you know, considering the ideas that this curriculum has if we weren't guided to accelerate the process and to listen more carefully to, you know, what can get us out of the imaginary quagmire that ego appears to have made up for us to be ensnared by. So I'll read one more paragraph and then maybe Lynn will be back. So
I'm back, but go ahead and read one more paragraph.
Oh, okay. Okay. Great. Okay. Okay. All right. So Gary says, I've been meaning to ask you a couple of questions that other people have asked. You mentioned it would be possible that a nuclear weapon could go off in a major city sometime. Is that still likely? In any details? Also, that Iranian guy you mentioned in the first series of visits, who you said might use nukes against us, he seems to have disappeared from the picture. Were you wrong about that? Personally, I wasn't wrong. Artin was, but I wasn't. Just kidding. this is what you want to remember. If the Course is teaching that what you're seeing in the world is an outer picture of an inward condition, then if you change the inward condition, the outer condition will also change. That's cause and effect. The good news is that because of the Course, the dissemination of which you play a part in, there's been enough forgiveness and healing of the mind that the former Iranian president isn't going to hurt you. Okay, you want to go on from there?
sure.
I'll let you read the bit of the bad news.
Drop there. yeah, okay. So this is a real example of the script is written, okay, and so all of these possibilities, when you think about all the imaginary possibilities that could happen. That's what was the script. The script is all the imaginary possibilities. We imagine that we could be nuked. We imagine that we could get cancer. We imagine that, you know, aliens could come here from another planet. We have all of these imaginary thoughts. Every single one of those imaginary thoughts was already here because we put it here. When we imagined a world without God, we imagine every possible scenario that can happen, including someone in Iran dropping a nuke on us. And that possibility, it was always there. It was always there in our imagination. And we chose whether or not to allow it to allow ourselves to be in a timeline where that actually happened. In some timeline, that did happen. In some part of the imaginary script that occurred, and all the after effects and ill effects and everything like that already were. And so we just chose to be in a timeline where that didn't happen. And as you forgive, what happens is that you move yourself, you know, when Jesus says you're collapsing time, actually is what you're doing is you're skipping a few grades. You're skipping and going into a place where that didn't happen and that can't happen and that never would have happened. And so you think about our imaginary world and all these imaginary thoughts that we have, you know, as long as we keep imagining them and believing that they are possible or capable of having real effect, then we're going to continue to have real effects.
Yeah. You know, as you're saying that, Lynn, if I can just comment on that, I think that when you said the script is written, I think that's the Cliff Notes version. But in terms of the ego's complexity, is the way we would probably think of it in this world, it's really the scripts are written. And there's, as you were kind of pointing out, there's, you know, at least the way I understand it, there's an infinite number of scripts, but we check, we, you know, we get to choose on some level or another which one we're in moment to moment by how vigilantly we look at our mind's contents and how much we practice forgiveness. In the book by Alexander Marchand, The Universe is a Dream, which is a wonderful, cartoon comic book sort of oriented, presentation of Course in Miracles ideas, which if you haven't seen it, it's really quite fun and very enjoyable read. He has a graphic in there that shows this sort of stair step, process by every time we forgive, we kind of get a little closer to, our source, by we're spinning around in this orbit, but the orbit gets a little closer to the oneness that we never left every time we make these quantum forgiveness jumps. And I think of it when you mentioned, graduation, or skipping a grade, I guess that was skipping the grade was the metaphor. I was thinking it's sort of like, every time we truly forgive, in a meaningful way, someone or something, it's almost like challenging a course. At least that's kind of the metaphor that kind of jumped into mind a moment ago, is that in some college classes, if you can demonstrate competency in the material by taking a test, and prove to the satisfaction of your professors that you understand the material, in some cases, well, I don't know if they do that much anymore, but I remember, in some cases you could challenge a class or even a whole grade, I suppose. And I think that's sort of analogous to what the quantum forgiveness is it basically says, here is this whole script that could have happened, and on some level, on some, parallel reality, parallel universe may have happened. But in terms of the one that we think we're in terms of our beliefs about the dream, there's another dream script that we've selected instead, and we, these little quantum jumps basically get us closer and closer to that. Ultimate awareness, which would be the revelation that we're talking about. I actually did take Alexander's wonderful diagram and modify it slightly and put it in, I think it was the last chapter of my second book, and commented about it there, which was on the topic on gender and generation. And so anyway, if anybody's interested, they can find that in that book, which you can go to geometrycode.com and get a copy of the book there. So a little quick plug. My second book, yeah.
But you know what? This is what you just said is perfectly true. And the point though is that I learned the lesson.
Exactly.
I learned the lesson. And if you went through life saying, Holy Spirit, let me learn the lessons I need to learn, mm-hmm. without the suffering. Mm-hmm. If it's a lesson on forgiveness, if it's a lesson on fear, if it's a lesson on money, worldly goods, whatever, let me learn that without going through the suffering. Right. I'm willing. And if you're willing to learn, you can learn. But if you're not willing to learn, you're going to have to take the class. You can't just jump in and say, I don't want to learn this lesson. You're still going to have to take the class because you can't graduate without it.
Exactly. That's why Jesus was joking with Helen, saying, because she asked, is this a required course? And Jesus' response was, yes, it's a required course, but the time you take it is voluntary. And then in Ken's commentary, and I think it was Absence from Felicity, he points out, that's been really misunderstood, that, the people think, well, it's the form that everybody has to take. No, it's, Course in Miracles is one of countless forms, as the Course itself points out. But the curriculum, the content in the mind, is something that everyone will need to undo in order to return home. And that's done by, the seemingly individual volition of each seeming person choosing against the insanity of the ego and making those quantum hyper jumps, in a cyclical manner, typically, until we recognize and generalize that, wow, I could be doing this all the time, instead of just now and then forgiving, I could be forgiving everything that seems to disturb my peace. And that's the supersonic transport ride, instead of the ox cart version, where we go through countless lifetimes, bumping and complaining along the way. We can actually take a pretty quick excursion home and bypass a lot of the suffering. But instead of waiting until our backs are against the wall, we just basically say, okay, I'm going to choose peace instead of this consistently. You know, I'm not upset for the reason I think. And recognize that consistently. And then that becomes a mechanism by which we return to the mind. We look gently at our condemning thoughts and say, oh, man, this isn't working. I've had too many experiences where I know the outcome of that and it's not good. So why would I want to go there again? So, anyway, to your point, Lynn, it really is just remembering to just look at the contents of the mind and not make a big deal out of the dream. And that gets us home quicker. So why not?
Exactly. And that is a choice. And, yeah. And so, you know, when this is why it's impossible for any of us to know where any other is on the ladder. I mean, it's impossible for you to know this. And for me, you know, the simplest thing is just to assume that everyone is in the best possible place they can be, learning the lessons that they need to learn in the best possible way.
Yep.
And then instead of arguing with them about where and what you think is happening, what they think is happening, you just can agree with them. Okay, yeah, you know, what you say is true for you, it is true for me. You know, I'm not going to reject it. I'm not going to be afraid of it. I'm not going to say, oh, you can't possibly, and, you know, who do you think you're fooling? Or, you know, if you accepted the atonement for yourself, you wouldn't even be here. Well, that's not true, because Jesus accepted the atonement for himself, and he walked around the earth and taught people. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he was killed and he came back to life. And, you know, he walked around in a body that he manufactured in order to be able to communicate, a true communication device. You know, his body became nothing but a communication device. And we have that choice. We don't have to be crucified for it. We just have that choice any minute to let our body be a true communication device. And that is what happens. That's it.
A quick aside that ties into what you just shared. The other day I thought, you know, I don't think I've listened to all of and watched all of Ken's YouTube videos. So I went to the FACIM YouTube channel, and I put them in reverse chronological order. And I've been listening and watching some of the early ones where Ken and Gloria were both in New York at the center there and sharing. And it was obvious that they both really, you know, certainly from what I got, you know, they obviously were very savvy on what the course was about early on. And you know, in this book, what we just read, I think last weekend, you know, Art Nipursa suggests that, you know, Ken was enlightened and I have no reason to doubt that. So, you know, he hung around for quite a number of years, because his early writings and his early sharings that were evidenced on that YouTube series were that he obviously got this stuff, and not only just intellectually, but he practiced it. And, you know, the feeling of kindness and the feeling of inclusiveness and warmth that he shared with everyone he met was evidence of that. And I think that's, you know, a great role model, if we need a role model to be the ultimate follower, you know, tying into previous thoughts about what Jesus was, you know, the exemplar for. Why wouldn't we want to follow those examples and have a, you know, a quicker ride out of our resistance? Huh?
Exactly, and that's absolutely, I think, absolutely true too. Because to me, you know, I could see Ken. And you can see how he was just genuinely humble, open, loving, kind, had no grievance against anybody, had no thought of anything other than just the truth. And it was very evident to me that he was awake. There is no doubt in my mind. So, you know, and knowing that that's not only possible, but it is inevitable that it will happen to you and me and everyone else, that it's our life. Uh-huh. You know, that's
it's a required course, huh? But we get what form and what time we want, but why not, you know, go for the quick ride home?
exactly. And you can do it, and you can do it through practicing forgiveness. There's no reason to doubt that anyone else has done it, because it's pretty evident that, like I said, that Ken did it. And so, you know, I and people are saying, well, it's going to take millions of years. Well, no, it's not. It is here and now.
Well, and even if it was the culmination of millions of years, so what? In countless lifetimes for Bill Thetford and Ken Wapnick and whoever else, you know, the three musketeers that didn't have muskets in this particular chapter, Jay, Nadav, and Mary, and so yeah.
Yeah, and so you know, if that's the case, then and in fact Jesus says to us many, many times, you know, I don't know how many times in the Course Jesus says, if you could just do this, you would eliminate thousands of years. Mm-hmm. You know, you just, every miraculous thought you have eliminates thousands of years. Every time you forgive, it eliminates thousands of years. I mean, honestly, all we're doing when we're doing that is cutting out sections of the story that no longer are necessary to our awakening, because we've learned a lesson. You know, it's like going through the chapter on addition and subtraction in your algebra book. If you already know addition and subtraction, you can just pull that chapter out. It's not in my algebra book or yours either. But, you know, if that was the case, that it was there, you don't have to read it. You don't have to practice it. You already know it.
Yeah. You know, another. I'm going to mix another metaphor. It's like I was just thinking, and Artin and Persa call this world an un-merry-go-round. I was just thinking that, well, if we challenge the course of the ego by you know, passing the test and challenging each test with forgiveness, true forgiveness, we make these quantum leaps, and those leaps are like going from a horse going up and down on the outer part of a merry-go-round to one on the inner part, and eventually we get to where it's completely still, you know, the center of the cyclone. So how's that a triple mix metaphor? you know, in that still spot, you know, like the fool on the hill, you know, we see the world going around, but we're not invested in it, you know. How's that for a quadruple Beatles song mix metaphor, is it?
Yeah, I know. Is there anything else you can throw in there?
No, I think that's enough for now. It's about this.
Kind of a slumgullion. That's what my mom used to call that, a slumgullion. I don't know what that's
funny, because I almost had slumgullion last night for dinner, because Nancy said, could you go out and get us a couple of bowls of chowder at the Lunacy, which is a local restaurant here in Yahats, Oregon. And I said, oh, sure. But I thought, well, slumgullion's good. But, you know, I haven't tried the chowder, so we both had a bowl of chowder.
Oh, how funny.
But their slumgullion is really good, actually, if you happen to be in Yahats, Oregon. And, of course, so is...
I didn't even know they had it on a menu somewhere. I thought it was really tasty.
Nope, it's good. It's like a fish stew kind of thing.
Yeah. Well, there we go. A little did I know, my mother was a gourmet cook, and we just thought she was just throwing everything that was in the fridge into a pot and cooking it up.
But ego's ship that tosses and you know, has all these tosses and turns that get us queasy in its ocean of separation really is a slum galleon. So we can afford to. Jump that ship, right?
Oh my God.
And get on ego's more peaceful cruise.
I think somebody should stop me.
Yeah.
Okay, so Gary. God. Gary says, okay, what's the bad news? All right, and so just to remind everybody, we're talking about, let's see, where are we at? The idea that that we didn't have a war and we didn't have a nuclear bomb go off and everything, that's the good news. And so Gary says, okay, so what's the bad news? And Persa says, the bad news is that the world has still not undergone a comprehensive awakening. The present condition of the mind is one of inner conflict. Thus, the mind will project events in the dream that are symbolic of that conflict. This makes it not only likely, but inevitable that at some time a nuclear bomb will go off in a major city. Remember, the ego demiurge wants to have bigger and more frightening events unfold in order to induce fear. Fear makes what you're seeing real, and the judgment that results from that keeps the ego's cherished projection intact. And I'm telling you what, reading this and seeing what's going on in the world right now with our political situation, this is why we need to start doing this work very sincerely and very thoroughly, is because as long as we continue to have these, allow these thoughts and think these thoughts of conflict and rejection and fear and war and, you know, all the things that seem to be happening in our political world today, if we buy into it and feed into it, we're making that inevitability of some major occurrence happening. It's only through removing the power from those thoughts and removing my mind is very powerful. It's my mind that's allowing or not allowing, you know, whatever travesties to happen in the world. And so it's my mind that needs to be changed. And so you can blame me for all of it, but because I blame myself. So they're saying it could happen. You know, that there's as long as this world of fear and conflict goes on, eventually we are going to have some terrible thing happen. So Gary says, I don't suppose you're going to tell me where and when. Persa, that would not be wise. The government isn't going to evacuate a major city on your say-so. So not only would it not do any good, it would set up all kinds of hassles and distractions for you. Instead, stick to your job. It's like we said about 9/11. If the students of the course don't forgive, who will? Who will? If I don't do it, who will? You know, we have a responsibility. And, you know, the fact that we picked up this blue book, you know, that wasn't because of some random happening. You know, I was guided directly to it, as I'm sure you were, and, you know, everyone else who has it and does it, is because we were given it directly for that reason, to save the world. We're here to save the world. That's why if you're not here to save the world, you just flush that book down the toilet and call a plumber, because you're going to need one. Anyway. So Gary says, I don't suppose you're going to tell me where and when. And Persa says, you know, just stick to your jobs. Just forgive, and everything will be okay. So now he's talking about this health thing. Another quick question in regard to the health section in the last book is about the 35% food-grade hydrogen peroxide, or HP, you told me to use to oxygenate my cells and prevent or heal all kinds of diseases. For example, you said cancer can't survive in the presence of oxygen. That's true. I know HP is magic, but I also know that it's okay to use it to help the body, allow the mind to heal the body. So I followed the instructions that were given in that small book you recommended, The 1-Minute Cure. I did the whole regimen, but most people tell me they can't do it. They can't take that many drops of the HP. That's purified hydrogen peroxide, or 35%.
Food grade is food important. Grade,
yes,
important primer, hydrogen peroxide, and it has to be really diluted. Yeah, because you don't want to. Yeah. You don't want to take it undiluted, obviously.
Right, it's not that much. I mean, yeah. Seriously.
And a quick disclaimer: we're not medical professionals, and this isn't to be considered medical advice. If anybody's listening to this,
that's right. That's right.
Since I've been steeped in legal stuff for the last few days with GDPR.
Well, yeah, and you know, the hydrogen peroxide, I know they're talking about, you know, the 35% food grade, but if you distill it enough, it really isn't any different, I don't think, than the hydrogen peroxide you can buy at the drugstore. So,
yeah, but you don't want to do that. Don't go there. Yeah.
Don't go there?
You can go on Amazon and get the food grade hydrogen peroxide and have it.
But the 35% is dangerous. That's
well, yeah. You keep that in the fridge, and then you dilute it as you put it in a little eyedropper, and then I've been doing that since Gary's book came out. And I figured, yeah, why not? You know, if that minimizes those things.
It really
does. Yeah, and that book outlines it, the 1-Minute Cure. If you read that, yeah.
So all I'm saying is that I used to work in a laboratory, and I know that highly concentrated hydrogen peroxide like that will burn a hole right through you.
Oh,
so,
sure. course,
you really need to know how to use it, and you need really how to dilute it. And that's what I'm saying. It doesn't have to be. You know, they're saying 35%. It doesn't have to be 35% because you're diluting it. If you know the aliquot, if you can calculate the actual dilution, then I'm not going to go into that.
That's a good Scrabble word you just said there. Aliquot. I remember that one.
Okay. So Artin says, yes, the hydrogen peroxide will still be effective in promoting health, even if you just take 9 or 10 drops a day in distilled water. Say 5 drops twice a day in 6 to 8 ounces of water. Make sure it's distilled because HP doesn't mix well with the impurities that are in most kinds of water. Also, keep the HP in the refrigerator to stop it from spoiling or losing its strength. Keep the water cold, too, because it will make the HP taste better. And be careful to make sure it's 35% food grade. If people do that every day, all kinds of benefits can result. And it doesn't take long to do at all to do it in the manner described here, which I don't understand why it would be difficult for people to take
that. I don't either. Because I did the formula that was an outline of that one-minute cure book, and it was pretty straightforward. You just kind of ramp up over a number of weeks and then ramp down, and then you kind of keep it at this few drops a day kind of level. And, it takes all of about 30 seconds, you know, to grab the little eyedropper bottle out of the medicine cabinet, put in a glass of water, and do that once or twice a day. And it's like, why not? I mean, can't hurt anything.
Exactly. And also, hydrogen peroxide is really just water with an extra oxygen in it. H2O2. Yep. It's just water with an extra oxygen. So it's just adding that extra oxygen into your system and picking it up in the bloodstream and taking it around through the
It's actually, I think, and you probably know more about this with your biochemistry background, but I think the way ozone is used to purify air and water sometimes, it basically that extra oxygen atom that yanks out things that are nasty from those environments.
Right. The oxygen binds to the whatever impurities, and that's why
radicals or whatever.
When you pour it on a infected wound or something, it bubbles.
Yeah.
As that oxygen is binding to the impurities and neutralizing them.
There you can use kind of the regular over the counter, drugstore food grade hydrogen peroxide for external use kind of thing. And that's exactly.
So, anyway.
Meanwhile, back at the metaphysics.
Meanwhile.
But this is helpful. If it helps people get out of fear, why not? There's nothing wrong with these magic things, right?
Oh, yeah. No, I take ibuprofen when I ache, and I drink coffee when I wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning to watch a royal wedding. So, here you go.
To hear some inspiring things, evidently. I might have to look for the replays. Yes.
Oh, it was amazing. Like I said, I just sat there and cried my eyes out. It was so beautiful. And Iris, you're experiencing it now, I'm sure. Oh, my goodness. It must be just incredibly joyful over there. I can't even imagine. Iris is in the room, and she's in the UK.
Oh, okay. So nice.
She's on next after us with Christopher, who's in Toronto. And so they're both Brits, basically. We may hear something about that. Okay.
Great.
So, just to let you guys know, I'm taking a class today. After I get off this call with Bruce, I'll be on a class all day with Richard Hartnett from the Prosperos, and it's a class called Translation. And oh my gosh, we started last night. It blew me away. My mind is just blown now. And I highly encourage, although it's very rare that they put on this class, if you ever hear from the Prosperos, you might enjoy this. It's really about changing your perspective to see the reality of what's happening, or the reality that's here and beyond the body. So translating it, whatever you see, into the truth. Okay, so let's see. We're on Gary. Thanks, I appreciate it. You know, you said earlier that this world is a hoax. Well, I was reading an article about my favorite film critic, Roger Ebert, who made his transition a couple of years ago. The article appears in Pathos Press and was written by Tom Rapsis, who recounts the words of Roger's wife, Chaz. Roger wasn't a particularly spiritual man, which made what his wife had to say even more interesting. I'll read that part of the article, and here it is. But most compelling to me were the events that happened in the days before Roger died. His wife, Chaz Ebert, tells us that her husband didn't know if he could believe in God. He had his doubts, but toward the end, something really interesting happened. Continuing with her words, the week before Roger passed away, I would see him, and he would talk about having visited this other place. I thought he was hallucinating. I thought they were giving him too much medication. But the day before he passed away, he wrote me a note. This is all an elaborate hoax. According to Chaz, she asked Roger, what's a hoax? Looking for some clarification. He then made it clear to her that he was talking about this world, this place. He said it was all an illusion. I thought he was confused, but he was not confused. Chaz went on to say that Roger described this other place as a vastness you can't even imagine. Sounds like a revelatory experience to me. So I guess you don't have to be heavy into spirituality to realize the true nature of this world and find that there's something far vaster and real that's just beyond it. Artin, an excellent note to end on, I think. The next three visits will be discussing something that we trust will encourage students to understand, stick with, and apply the incredible power of non-duality. As A Course in Miracles says about the advanced student, now he begins to see, and this is from the Manual for Teachers, I believe, now he begins to see the transfer value of what he has learned. Its potential is literally staggering, and the teacher of God is now at the point in his progress at which he sees in it his whole way out. Persa, we love you, brother. Give Cindy a great big hug for us. And with that, which is kind of funny because Artin and Persa are Gary and Cindy. So give Cindy a big, great big hug for us. And with that, they disappeared in an instant, leaving me to try to fathom the possible transfer value of all that they and Jay's course had taught me so far. And that is the end of that chapter.
Good stuff, huh?
Really good stuff. Really good stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, as a quick aside, I'm actually going to be doing a recording with Gary and Cindy for the Miracle Share Conference that's coming up on October in a few days. So they'll have that recorded so that in October, it's the 19th, 20th, and 21st is when the conference is taking place in virtual space, and then it'll be available for viewing after that and listening to. And so anyway, yeah, good stuff.
Very good stuff.
Good stuff. Yeah, so, and Cindy's sister Jackie Laura Renard was also going to be one of the participants of that as well. So
very cool. Very
yeah.
cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, awesome sauce.
do you want
to go ahead?
Should we start in chapter 8, or just muse a bit on what we've talked about so far?
I'm thinking maybe because I have to be in that other class in a short while.
Oh, okay. Just wrap up early.
Just wrap it up early. And
oh, okay. That's fine.
I was going to mention that earlier that maybe we could wrap it up a little early, but
sure.
Now it's early and now we can wrap it up.
Okay.
And, so the next chapter we'll be starting on next week is J Channel, 1965 to 1977. This time the truth will not be buried. And, of course, he's talking about A Course in Miracles. So I'm so excited. Yay.
Yeah, yeah.
All right.
Looking forward to reading that with you. So have a great week, Lynn, and everyone. And we'll check in next week.
All right. Thank you so much, Bruce. And I'm going to put on some music to play until it's time for Christopher and Iris. So once again, thank you, Bruce Rawls. And thank you, everyone, for joining us today.
Likewise.